Find the life you didn't think was possible with the Jesus you never knew. Together, let's slow down a little and pay better attention to the most significant person in history. Welcome to the podcast, Paying Ridiculous Attention to Jesus, with your host, Rick Lawrence, brought to you by LifeTree. Visit us at JesusCenteredLife.com.
Well, hi, listeners. This is Season 8, Episode 4 of Paying Ridiculous Attention to Jesus. My name is Rick. I'm author of many books over the years, but my latest is coming out in just a couple of months. It's called Editing Jesus. The tagline is Confronting the Distorted Faith of the American Church. So it sounds like kind of an in-your-face title for a book. And in some ways it is in your face, but really the focal point of the book is recapturing the essence of Jesus and recognizing how far we've strayed from actually following him. To follow him means to uphold what he stood for, his values and priorities, above all. To follow him means that he's shaping us. We're not shaping him. And that's what the book's about. It's what does it mean, really, to walk in the way of Jesus, to walk as he walked. So joining me today, of course, is Becky Crawley, better known as the Beckynator. Beckynator, if you've listened for a long time, you know how she got that name. But if this is your first time listening or your second time listening, you may think, what a weird name. But actually, that name came up organically because soon after I met Becky, I realized, oh, Becky is one of those people who just gets things done. Surrounding Becky is things getting done. And I have to say, it's a very rare quality. I don't know many people over the whole course of my life that I put in the same category as the Beckynator. And it was obvious to me from when I first met her. So these are, and Becky, because of this quality that she has, it creates trust. Like when you meet people who basically don't just let their words do the talking, but they act on things, it creates a deep level of trust. And for those of you who've listened for a long time and then also listened during the time when Becky wasn't on the podcast, you can tell already the difference in having Becky back in the mix. So I'm just so grateful that we're able to do this every other week. So this is the 8th episode in a series I'm calling The Ways of Jesus. And that, like I mentioned, is the undercurrent of this new book, Editing Jesus. So every other week, we'll just be exploring the heart of Jesus by taking a deeper dive into the way he lived and loved others and modeled what life looks like for us. So, and today we're going to dive into a way of living that seems, kind of weak, but we know from scripture, it's not just words from Jesus to Paul that we know where Paul says, take this thorn away from me. And Jesus says, nope, I'm not going to do it because my power is perfected in weakness. What? My power is perfected in weakness, but this is central to the way Jesus lives and the central to the invitation he gives us to live in his way. So it's in our weakness, in the way of living that honors our weakness, that we find our greatest strength. So the corollary to that is if we're walking in the way of Jesus, then mercy, mercy, mercy will be our path. That's what we're going to dive into today. So just a little preamble here. Not long ago, I was working on a project for Vibrant Faith, which is, I'm executive director of this small but iconic ministry resourcing and training and coaching and research organization. I've been in that executive director's chair for about 3.5 years. And we create a lot of really amazing little resources as part of what we do. And I was working on one of them and had recruited some outside writers to contribute to that. And then I was editing their ideas. And one of those writers who I was really depending on, she had, I think, she had like half of the ideas that we were including in this resource. She had about half of them assigned to her. And I kept getting delay notices from her. Like I'd check in, just before the deadline to find out if it was on its way, and she would tell me it wasn't. And then I would extend her deadline. And finally, I kind of had to have them. And so I said, really, I need to know, are you going to be able to deliver these? So let me just read you the email that she sent me in response to that request. And then, Becky, I'd love for you to think about this as I'm reading this. If you were me, what would you have done after receiving this email? So again, it's past deadline. We have a deadline. We have a target date to release this resource. She had accepted quite a lot of work, so it wouldn't be easy to replace. And she had kind of put me off, and I'd given her an extended deadline already. So here's what she wrote. Hi, Rick. I'm so sorry. I'm really behind on these talk sheets. I keep setting aside time to write, but it keeps getting interrupted by life, and I've been too overwhelmed to even think about it. I didn't want this to be your experience with me, and I want to make sure what I send is some of my best work. A little background: in April, my father's cancer returned and he began chemo. My grandmother started home hospice, and my church reopened after 2.5 years on Easter. I managed all of this by reconnecting to the why behind my calling and remained connected, even though I'm a 3-hour flight away. But I wasn't prepared for the compounded grief to hit me so hard. This month, I'm completing my second year in seminary, and as I was preparing for finals, one of the students who's in my community engagement cohort and lives on campus with me died suddenly on campus, and her death really took the wind out of me. I had to take a week to step away from everything in order to regroup, and so I'm trying to ramp back up to my full capacity, yet it's taking far longer than I expected. It's requiring me to move slowly. I appreciate all the grace you've extended and would like to see this through, yet I'm feeling rather disconnected from the process and its impact, which has added to my writer's block. I'd like to start over if there's time and space. Is it possible to set a new deadline and start this process in a conversation with you about the way these will be used? I've relieved myself of most of my responsibilities for the summer after finals are over next week. Thank you for your time, consideration, and prayers. Signed, this woman. So there you have her kind of lengthy response to my and it, she went kind of deep into her own life here and what was causing this. You can tell that she really wanted me to understand what had been going on with her. But Becky, again, what if you were me? How would you have responded to her?
Well, for the last 5 years, I've been managing a lot of people, whether that's outside contractors or internal people. And in the last 2 years, I've been leading other leaders. So I've had people who are underneath me who are also leading other people. And one of the things that I have really realized about leading people and about telling people how to lead other people is that you have to earn respect. Respect isn't something that a title gives you. It's not something that is owed to you. And it's not something that you just get for being someone's boss. It's something that you earn. And I think that the way that you earn respect with people, the way that you walk into a room and you don't even have to use your title, I think that that's what true leaders do, is they walk into a room and no one has to say, that person's in charge. Everyone knows they're in charge because of the way that they handle themselves. And I think that part of that is that you care about people's lives, that you care about who they are and what's going on with them. And when you show people that you really care, that you get respect. You get really, really deep respect. They'll do anything for you. And that is not really how the world handles things. I've worked inside Christian organizations where I've had, group publishing was wonderful environment that always put people first to the point where sometimes it just upended me, the way that they put people first. But that is not the experience that you're going to get out in the secular world. They're going to put the business first and the needs of the business first. And so in this case, right, this is an outside contractor. How I would have handled it is I would have given them permission. Well, first I would have evaluated, can I wait? Do you have the, does the business have the ability for you to wait? And if it does, and this is the right person for the project, then you could extend that deadline. If it doesn't, if the business can't wait, then I would give this person what they need, is which is an out. I would say, you know what? Thank you so much. We'd love to pay you for whatever time you've put into this. You have so much going on. Unfortunately, we just can't move the deadline, and we would love to keep working with you, but the business needs to get this deadline. So can we pay you for what you've done? And then I would find someone else to finish the project. I just think that what you have to care about in this situation is the person and what they're going through. And I've worked with creative people for my entire career, and I fully, completely understand creative people cannot give you their best work when their life is in chaos. They just can't. And I've had contractors who have gone through major life situations, and you just have to say, you know what, I got to give you an out here. You need to go take care of yourself and get back on track, because you're not going to be able to find some creative well in you. It doesn't exist until you get healing. And that's part of just caring people. It's about how you communicate. And so that's how I would have handled it. I think you have to show people that you care. What will happen in that situation, you go take care of whatever the business, you find the right contractor who can get the job done, but that person will be loyal to you. They'll come back when their life is there. But if you handle it in such a way that you have no sympathy for them and you get mad and you don't pay them for the time that they've put in, they're not going to want to do work for you again. Yeah. And it's hard to find good creative people. So I think that there's an element of, you just have to give people grace, because that's how you earn respect as leaders.
Yeah, that's really good. And what's interesting is that there's mercy all around in this scenario. There's mercy that is invited for the organization. How are you merciful to the organization who has its own stresses and problems and challenges and struggles and has a project that needs to get finished? How do you have mercy to the organization? How do you offer mercy to yourself as a leader? And how do you offer mercy to the people that you're dealing with? And sometimes those three vectors of mercy, you can't have all of them. You can't offer mercy to one and also offer mercy to the other at the same time sometimes. So what do you think, Becky, influences you to offer or to withhold mercy? And would you ever withhold mercy?
So I do think that there is this kind of like balance between mercy and accountability. And right now, the team that I manage, I have, we'll just say, varying levels of adults in my that are underneath me. I have some really highly responsible people who I trust completely, all the way down to people who I feel like are barely graduating into adulthood. And I feel like I'm actually teaching them how to be regular adults. And they always have, some of those people always have an excuse, right? Like they always have something going on. And so part of me showing them how to show up for themselves and their lives is I have to hold them accountable. And so there is a balance. You know, if you have a crisis in your life, you know, we had one of our employees, we were on an event. It was this event was like his main job. He got a call. His spouse was being taken to the hospital right as we were right in the thick of it. And my immediate response was leave, go, we'll figure it out. Right. That was outside of his thing. Mm-hmm. But when I have someone who comes up to me and they're like, my dog is sick, you know, I'm sorry, you need to show up today. Right. Like we have to hold you accountable. And part of that is there's just this balance. And I don't think Jesus ever applied mercy without having some level of accountability.
Yeah. That's really good. I love the way you framed that there, Becky. And it made me think of, as you were talking, I wrote a book a while back called Spiritual Grit, which was about the way that Jesus interacts with us to build our grit, because grit is life-giving in our lives. He knows that if we develop grit, we'll have fruit in our life. The ability to persevere is hard won in all of our lives. And Jesus is a participant in that process with us. This is what vexes us about him so often, is why don't you make my life smoother and easier? Why is this so hard? And some of that just comes from living in a broken world, obviously.
Yes.
Some of it is, you know, we have clear examples where he kind of went out of his way to think, make things hard on people sometimes. And there's a story in that book, Spiritual Grit, about, I call it the butterfly effect, but it's, there's two versions of that story. One is how a butterfly flaps its wings and weather changes across the world. This is a different version of that. It's about a butterfly and how they emerge from their cocoon. And it takes a fight for a butterfly to emerge from its cocoon. They have to fight their way out. And there was a man who was watching this fight and thinking that this butterfly wasn't going to make it. It looked like the butterfly was exhausted and had given up. And so what he did was he cut the cocoon. He took a little pair of scissors and he cut the cocoon. And then the butterfly could get out of the cocoon, but it died soon after. And what he realized in retrospect is that that fight created the strength in the wings of the butterfly, and so it could survive. And he had actually unknowingly, through his empathy, actually paved a path for the butterfly to die. And so mercy isn't always expressed either from Jesus to us or from us to others by simply being nice to people. You know, you and I have both had people, and you just explained a little bit there. We both had people in our lives who we are leaders for, who, as you said at the start, hadn't yet earned our trust. In fact, we had doubts about them. And so mercy for a person like that is not to cut open their cocoon to make everything easier for them. Mm-mm. Mercy for a person like that is actually to make things harder, so that they can gain the strength they need to develop a trusting relationship. It's hard to know the difference between the two sometimes. Have you had a story, Becky, where you experienced mercy? And there's a quality about mercy that it's unfair. Usually when we're either receiving or giving mercy, there's some aspect of unfairness about it. Fairness isn't really the issue in a lot of the ways we experience mercy. But have you had a story when you experienced mercy, and what did that feel like?
Yeah, I mean, Rick, you remember the last, you know, few weeks that I was working, or even the last few months that I was working at group publishing, and just, you know, my life was in such turmoil, and yeah, things were, you know, I had to leave work and deal with things, and there was so much going on. And at one point, I wasn't sure if it was safe for me to be in Fort Collins. And so I was allowed to work remote from a different location for a while. And oh my gosh, I just can't believe how much mercy I received from my place of work during that time. Like, honestly, I don't think that out in the secular work world, I would have been probably forced to just take a leave of absence unpaid, or, you know, I would not have been provided not just the communal support, but also just grace around my position that I was given during that time. I mean, I don't think anyone treats people with so much love and respect in the workforce is what I experienced. And I am so grateful, truthfully, for that time when, you know, eventually I ended up having to say, you know what, I'm going to have to leave. But there was never even an expression of pressure for me to make that decision from my employer. I got to make that all by myself without any pressure at all. So
yeah, it's probably important to note too that, I mean, even thinking about the little thumbnail of the story you just shared, that there is, this is going to sound a little weird given what we've said already, but there is something conditional about mercy And the condition is, what is the best good for the other? And that's what mercy serves. And in your case, you were a highly respected, valued, important contributor to the team who always came through. That's how you got the nickname, Beckynator. So it wasn't an issue of your work ethic or any doubts about that. And there was a recognition of your life situation. When you said it wasn't safe, there was real reasons why you were not safe. You were not in a safe position at that time in your life, and you needed the anonymous space that you could get. And the organization recognized that too. And so it can sound like conditions, but it actually is responding to what mercy requires in that moment. I was remembering that my daughter, Emma, who's in college, she had a physiology professor who, showed no mercy for something. She had an assignment that she was supposed to turn in. And my father passed away rather suddenly. So we scrambled and arranged for my daughter to come home from school so she could be there in time for the funeral. And she had to scramble too with her schedule and all the commitments she had. And she was trying to finish this assignment for her physiology professor and turn it in on time, but she had to get on a plane and there's no Wi-Fi for her to use on that plane. And so she had to, when she landed, she stopped and sent in the assignment, but it was an hour late. And when she told her professor about why she was late, that she was going to her grandfather's funeral and here's what happened, he said, sorry, rules are rules. So you're not allowed to use your notes in the final exam for this class because the prerequisite for that is you turn this last assignment in on time. You didn't do it, so you don't get to use your notes. And it was so hard for my daughter to get her mind around this because it seemed unfair, but deep and underneath that, the conditions required for mercy seemed to be there. And when you violate those, there's something deeply disruptive to our soul when the parameters for mercy are just violated. And that's how she felt. And I remember how, you know, she, and by extension, she, you know, she's angry at the professor because of this, but also she's like, God, why didn't you advocate for me here? And so God has, Jesus has intentions in the midst of our mess and ugliness. Even when we don't get the mercy we long for, he still has intentions and how he can recover that.
Yeah, I think college, you know, college professors, they believe that they are preparing you for the real world, right? And so, and unfortunately, Rick, here's the thing, like working out in the secular world, that is exactly the kind of treatment you're going to get. I mean, it's just, it's why, you know, I've gone back and forth in my career. I've worked in Christian ministry, then I worked in the secular world, then I came in, I worked for a Christian publisher, and then I've gone back to the secular world. And every time I go back to Christian ministry or working in a Christian environment, it's almost like you have to adjust. You're like, wait a minute, no one's out here to get me. I don't have to like be looking behind my back. You're like freaking out because that is how it is. But you know what is really cool about this time that I've kind of gone back into working in the secular world is one of the coolest things that you can do that really sets you apart from everyone else, especially if you're in a leadership role, is if you do give grace when grace should be extended, it is upending for people. They don't understand why you're so different. Because the thing is that I'm hard on the accountability, and everyone knows that I hold high standards. If you're working for me, you're going to be held accountable. There's going to be high standards. We're going to get stuff done together. We're going to have a fun time doing it, but we're going to get stuff done. But then this grace gets applied and it's like, whoa, where did that come from? That is really what leadership is, but that's not what you're going to experience out there. It's not what you're going to experience in life. And so, you know, these university professors, they are being told by businesses. We need you to prepare them for how it's going to be when they get here. And that is how it's going to be when you get there. There's going to be a very no show of mercy most of the time.
Yeah.
Your boss is not going to care. If you have a, you know, family emergency or your kid's sitter didn't show up or whatever, like you just don't get a ton of grace or really any care as a person for the most part in that world. So
yeah, you know, is it interesting as you were talking about that, I was thinking about when you said offering grace and mercy in an environment where it's unexpected can really stick out and have a powerful influence. And it reminds me that mercy in that kind of environment seems like weakness, doesn't it? Like if you were really a strong leader, you would just hold their feet to the fire and everyone would be scared of you. I just saw a piece on, I think it was CNN.com, about a leader at a chain of vegan restaurants. And he's kind of the guy in the vegan food world. And the whole article was about how he was horrible to work for. And somebody was quoted saying, if you've ever had contact with him, you never come away unscathed from this guy. And yeah. So you get the picture of this very demanding, I don't care what you're going through kind of guy. The company's goals are above everything, that kind of thing. And that feels that is, I think, framed as strength in some ways in our culture. So offering grace and mercy can be framed as weakness, but it's actually, you did a great job of describing how mercy is actually a strength. It's transformational in people's lives. It's transformational in our lives and the lives of others as you discern what mercy requires with each person. And it takes discernment because it's not a cookie cutter approach to mercy. It's mercy is whatever is needed in the moment for the person's best good. Becky, I'm a huge fan of jazz, not soft jazz or smooth jazz, but kind of classic jazz, especially improvisational jazz. And one of my favorite pieces in the jazz canon is a song called Mercy, Mercy, Mercy. It's a tune that was first played and recorded by a giant in the jazz world. His name is Cannonball Adderley. He was an iconic saxophonist, and he had a 1966 recording where he was leading his jazz quintet in a live recorded performance. And this song, Mercy, 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 was written by his keyboard player, who is a very talented songwriter. His name is Joe Zawinul. And the song, again, is called Mercy, Mercy, Mercy. And we're going to listen to just a little bit of it just now. And you'll hear in Cannonball Adderley's intro to the song, because it's a live recording, that he's saying that this instrumental piece that you're about to hear sounds like what you're supposed to do when you're in trouble or facing a big challenge. So he's saying the music is speaking a language, and is, if you just listen to the music with no, there's no lyrics to it, but if you listen to the music, it will communicate mercy to you. So I'm assuming you have never heard this song, Becky. So I'm going to play it and we can close our eyes and relax and listen to it for a minute or so. And all I'm going to ask you to do is think about, what does mercy sound like? Cannonball Adderley says it sounds like this song. What do you pick up in the song that communicates mercy to you? So let's listen to a minute or so of this. Here we go.
You know, sometimes we're not prepared for adversity. When it happens, sometimes we're caught short. We don't know exactly how to handle it when it comes up. Sometimes we don't know just what to do when adversity takes over. And I have advice for all of us. I got it from our pianist, Joe Zawinul, who wrote this tune. And it sounds like what you're supposed to say when you have that kind of problem. It's called mercy, mercy, mercy.
No!
Okay, Becky, there's a little snippet of Mercy, Mercy, Mercy by Cannonball Adderley's band, 1966. So as you were listening to that, how would you answer the question, what does mercy sound like?
It's like kind of like a mixture of peace that you don't understand where it's coming from. And I think that there was quite a bit of like joy, like just like that kind of joy was like the high sounds. It was like something about it made me feel like in the beginning, it was kind of like you could tell there was like these low notes. He was kind of maybe going through something. And then all of a sudden Mercy came in and just relieved the pressure, and sounded like, why would I get to have this, you know?
Oh, I love that. That's really good. And there's an interesting crescendo in this, a repeated crescendo. It's almost like, to me, when I listen to it, it's almost like you're being led to the edge of a cliff and then you drop off the cliff. And dropping off the cliff is peace. But there's a buildup I don't know if tension is the right word, but there's a buildup of emotion that happens in this piece. And then the antiphone to that buildup is this kind of sonorous peace that comes in, almost like a warm blanket or something like that. Kind of maps to what you were saying there, that there's this juxtaposition of something that builds up in us. And maybe a way to say that, I guess, is that our sense of our own neediness becomes more and more present to us. And then it can also envelop us, our sense of our own neediness sometimes. And out comes mercy, 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 just have mercy on me. And I know for me, one of the things that I breathe as a prayer throughout my day, I don't even notice I'm doing it anymore because I've been doing it for so long, is I will pray this prayer of Jesus, have mercy on me. Jesus, have mercy on me. And it's when things are bubbling up in my life, where I'm feeling that sense that I get in this music as well, that there's a crescendo happening. And so it kind of automatically flips this little toggle in my soul, and I just pray, Jesus, have mercy on me. And like I said, I don't always realize I'm even praying it when it happens. So that was an auditory experience of mercy, a different way of experiencing what this is. But let's engage all of who we are to explore a little bit the essence of mercy in the heart of Jesus. So we're going to move through a little sampler of how Jesus approached mercy and how mercy reflects the heart of God. And what we're doing here is paying ridiculous attention to him to understand what mercy looks like and feels like, and what are his parameters around it. Why does he make the choices around mercy that he does? So let's explore what the way of mercy modeled by Jesus really looks like. And we'll tackle as many of these as we can in the time that we have. But by way of an intro, in Matthew 5, in one of the first of the Beatitudes in Matthew 5, Jesus is standing on a hillside. It's really his first, sort of public, I guess you could call it, teaching. And it's the only time really when Jesus is trying to help people to grow where he just talks. So that's why it's called the Sermon on the Mount. It's because there's like a couple of chapters of him just talking. And this doesn't happen again in Scripture. It's interesting that this happens at the beginning of his public ministry. And I believe the reason why he just talks to kick off his ministry is it's almost shock and awe introduction of what the kingdom of God really looks like in comparison to what we're used to. So he just fire hoses people with how different the kingdom of God is from human understanding of what is good and right and and worth modeling. So in one of his first Beatitudes, Matthew 5:7, he says, God blesses those who are merciful, for they will be shown mercy. God blesses those who are merciful, for they will be shown mercy. And so he's saying that people who show mercy get mercy. I mean, it's kind of a hard reality. If you are unwilling to show mercy, then you probably shouldn't expect to be shown it yourself. The only one that supersedes that little equation is Jesus himself. Sometimes his grace goes so far as to give mercy to even the unmerciful. But that's how he starts off his Beatitudes. But so there's a little on-ramp intro into it. Let's explore a little story here of when Jesus called Matthew. And again, we're looking for how and why does Jesus express mercy in this encounter? So I'll read it, and then Becky, I'd love to hear your perspective on it. This is from Matthew 9:9-13. As Jesus was walking along, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at his tax collector's booth. "Follow me and be my disciple," Jesus said to him. So Matthew got up and followed him. Later, Matthew invited Jesus and his disciples to his home as dinner guests, along with many tax collectors and other disreputable sinners. That's one of my favorite phrases, disreputable sinners. But when the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with such scum?" When Jesus heard this, he said, "Hey, healthy people don't need a doctor. Sick people do." And then he added, "Now go and learn the meaning of this scripture. I want you to show mercy, not offer sacrifices. For I've come to call not those who think they're righteous, but those who know they're sinners." And here he's referencing an Old Testament passage from Hosea 6, where God is speaking, and he says, "I want you to show love, not offer sacrifices. I want you to know me more than I want I want you to know me more than I want burnt offerings." So Jesus there is actually agreeing with the voice of God in the Old Testament when he's responding this way to the Pharisees. So Becky, what do you see Jesus elevating and practicing with mercy in this situation?
Well, I mean, it's really hard, I think, to know your need for God. If you're living a blameless life, right? We see this a lot of times. I mean, there are just people who are born with really great self-discipline, right? I mean, I think mine's like medium. But I have a friend who has like extra high self-discipline. I mean, everything that she sets out to do, she does. Every diet, every exercise plan, she can get herself up at 4:30. And she is just like ultimate discipline. And I just look at her and I'm like, I have like 50% of that. So, but when you live a life and you don't need God, it's really hard for you to turn to him, you know, and, to go and in the same way, I think it's even harder for you to understand how to give mercy to other people. If you yourself think, "Oh, well, look at me and all my, you know, I've been able to do this. I can do it all in my own strength. Why can't you do it all on your own strength?" I think it's really easy in the church for us to look at other people and just wonder why it is that they can't be as self-disciplined as us. And the truth of it is I think I would rather be the person who knew their need for God, just knew that I had so many shortcomings, because I do think it would be harder to live a life that actually exemplifies what Jesus wants from us if you did have all that natural gifting and you could just be your own Jesus. You could, yes, be your own way to the yeah, to salvation.
Yeah, right? I think what you pointed out here is just crucial, because this dynamic of neediness, of awareness of your need, is exactly the reason why Jesus gathered the people around him that he did. In fact, all of his disciples, all of them, including Matthew, who was despised and kept out of good Jewish society. The reason there was only disreputable sinners at the dinner is that's his only friends. That's who Matthew invited to dinner because those were his friends. So all of the disciples had some obvious neediness in one way or another. If you think about Peter, we always think of it like he's the rock. Jesus renamed Simon Peter the rock. But remember, Peter's first encounter with him was on his own boat when he was forced to listen to Jesus teach from the deck of his boat when he was already done fishing for the day and wanted to go home. Jesus said, no, I need to get out of your boat because the crowd's pressing in. And so Peter agrees and he's sitting there listening to this guy. And when Jesus is done teaching, he tells Peter to throw the net over the side. And Peter, experienced fisherman, said, we're going to get nothing. We're in shallow water. It's past the time when you catch fish. That's stupid. You're not a fisherman. He's thinking these things, I think.
And Saul had no mercy for people. Saul was a perfect example of that. You know, I have all this self-discipline and all this self-righteousness, and I can apply no mercy to anyone else. And then God takes his sight away from him, and that's when he becomes Paul. He has to get Saul into a place of need,
yeah,
to show him his weakness in order for him to get on the right path.
You're exactly right. And what Peter says, after the fish get hauled onto board, the first thing he says is, "You need to get off my boat. I'm a sinful man." That's the first thing he says to Jesus. You shouldn't even be on my boat. You shouldn't be this close to me. You have no idea what a terrible person I am. That's what he's saying. And I think that Jesus sees that and says, oh, you're open then. So our whole life with Jesus is really about attachment. This is why he said, you're the branch, I'm the vine. Attach to me and you'll find life, because you can't do anything unless you're attached to me. Well, how does attachment happen? This is how it happens. It happens when we admit that we need mercy and we open ourselves to him in a humble way. Like you said, Becky, just a minute ago, if you got it all dialed in, you not only are your own salvation, but you're not going to open yourself as a branch grafted into the vine. You will not seek grafting, because you don't think you need the life of that vine, right? I got enough life of my own in the branch. It's only the branches that recognize they don't have all of the life they need that attach themselves to the vine. And that is a key thing in what it means to walk with Jesus. How aware are you of your need? And how honest are you about it? And how willing are you to invite his mercy into your weakness? Maybe we can do one more story here before we close off here, Becky. This is one's from Matthew 12. And Jesus is reiterating this whole theme again. I want mercy, not sacrifice. So this is from Matthew 12, verses 1-8. And we'll close off with this one. At about that time, Jesus was walking through some grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry, so they began breaking off some heads of grain and eating them. Okay, this is against the rules. They're not supposed to be doing this on the Sabbath, so they're already rule-breaking, and Jesus is right there with them. but some Pharisees saw them do it and protested. Hey, look, your disciples are breaking the law by harvesting grain on the Sabbath. Jesus said to them, haven't you read in scriptures what David did when he and his companions were hungry? Well, he went into the house of God and his companions broke the law by eating the sacred loaves of bread that only the priests were allowed to eat. And haven't you read in the law of Moses that the priests on duty in the temple may work on the Sabbath? I tell you, there's one here who is even greater than the temple. But you would not have condemned my innocent disciples if you knew the meaning of this scripture. I want you to show mercy, not offer sacrifices, for the Son of Man is Lord, even over the Sabbath. So here he's referencing Hosea 6 again, as he's talking to these Pharisees. So what sticks out to you in this story, Becky?
Well, this is our age-old problem where, you know, we just as human beings, we want black and white rules to follow. We want a guaranteed path to salvation. We want a ritual to follow. And we don't want it to be confusing or messy. And so, you know, mercy is, it's messy. You have to find, in order to have mercy, you have to see people, you have to be in relationship with people, you have to be in, if you're going to have mercy from God, you have to be in relationship with Him. If you're going to show mercy to other people, then you have to have relationship with them. We can't live in this like way where we're outside of everything and we can isolate ourselves from it. And I think that today we do the same things. We want to put people into categories. We want to put them into boxes and say, these people deserve mercy and these people don't deserve mercy. And unfortunately, I mean, that means that we're going to limit the kind of mercy that we can receive for ourselves if we continue to only look at people in those boxes.
Yeah. And it makes me think too, that the kind of another superseding issue here is about God, the justice in the heart of God. Justice is a huge motivating factor in the heart of God. But justice is not always fair. Real justice, it operates in the realm of grace and mercy. It's not always fair in the way that we demand fairness. So another way of saying that is that fairness could be just, but justice isn't always fair. And
accountability doesn't always look like mercy.
That's true.
When you're holding people accountable, it doesn't always look like mercy. But I do think that sometimes when you are holding people accountable, you are showing them mercy, because if you don't do it and they continue going on in their life, not being accountable, it will cause them problems forever and ever. And I think as you become parents, as you become leaders, it's really hard, because if you care about people, and this is probably most seen with our children, is we just want to remove all the barriers. We want to make it easy. You know, we don't want them to experience the same hardships that we've experienced. We want to do all of this stuff and just kind of clear the path. But at the same time, if you don't hold accountability, they're going to trip up a lot in life.
Right.
Yeah. You're not showing mercy to them by doing that either. So I do think that there's this balance that's in a constant in any kind of leadership position that you're in, whether it's in your home, your work, your life, whatever it is, that you have to have this balance of accountability and mercy.
Yeah.
And mercy isn't just turning a blind eye to everyone's behavior.
It's desiring what is good for the other, and it's fundamental. And it reminds me too that Jesus had a big problem with the Pharisees around issues like this. Like when he healed on the Sabbath and they had a problem with it, what he said was, well, even in your own household, if you had a goat or a cow fall down the well on the Sabbath, you would rescue that thing from the well. But you're saying you're justified in that, which means that you have more compassion for your cow than you do for this man who's struggled for and hungered for healing his whole life. That's a violation of justice and mercy in the heart of God. So really what Jesus is saying, I think, in this encounter is, hey, my disciples aren't doing anything worthy of your scorn. There's nothing wrong happening here. The Sabbath was made for, men were made for the Sabbath, not the other way around, meaning that the Sabbath is designed to honor God. And what they're doing is not dishonoring God by eating some grain on the Sabbath. So he's basically saying, you've lost sight of the bigger picture here of what is really true goodness. And all you're doing is rule keeping right now. That's all you're doing is you're making sure the rules are kept. So, and that's not what mercy does. Mercy is not a rule keeping thing that we experience from Jesus. And that's why it's unfair. He allows unfairness into our life to offer us mercy. So, and it's for the same reasons that we just talked about. What does goodness look like? How can he nurture goodness in our life? So today, as you think about this whole theme of mercy, I guess the invitation here at the end is to pick up on what Jesus picked up on, all those who were closest to him. If you want to be close to Jesus and you have been reluctant to get in touch with your own need for mercy, then maybe it's time to take some silent time and consider where you need his mercy. Consider how much you need him. Consider laying down your defenses for a little bit to admit your great need for him. When you do that, you are opening yourself to being grafted into the vine. You're saying, I need the life that you have, because the life I have isn't quite enough. Any last closing thing from you, Becky, here?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that at the root of all of it is that mercy is a relationship requirement, but on both ends. Like, you have to, in order to get mercy from God, you have to enter into a relationship with God, and you have to start talking to God. And in the same vein, when we're looking at people and we're refusing to give mercy, it's usually because we're not talking, right? You could have, that person who wrote you that email, he trusted you enough to tell you all of those things. But a lot of times you just hear, I can't get it done. And if you want to know why someone can't get done, ask, what's going on in your life? I can't tell you how many times I've just said, hey, before I get into what happened last week, let's just talk about what's going on in your life. And you open that relationship invitation with someone, the next thing you know, this is a situation where I need to apply some grace, because I didn't know any of this was going on in them. But you can't get there without a relationship. You can't get there without that kind of dialogue with people.
Yeah, because again, to put an exclamation point on the end of this, mercy adjusts to the person in front of it. That's what Jesus did. His mercy adjusted to the person in front of him. And the only way you can find out what that person's need for mercy is, whether it looks like accountability or just flat grace, is to understand their story. Getting to know another story is the pathway. And don't forget, the same applies to ourselves, getting to know our own story. If you have not yet come to embrace your own story, aspects of your story that are painful, that you wish weren't part of your story, so you keep them from others and you even keep them from yourself, maybe it's time to re-embrace the hard edges of your story. Because in that place, you'll crescendo, just as mercy, mercy, mercy crescendos. You'll crescendo to a place where you invite that kind of mercy. Well, thanks again for listening to this episode of Paying Ridiculous Attention to Jesus. It's a podcast from ricklawrence.com. You can subscribe on iTunes or SoundCloud or Spotify or whatever your favorite podcast service is, Apple. You can subscribe on any of those to Paying Ridiculous Attention to Jesus. And Becky and I will be back in a couple of weeks. We'll see you then. Bye, Becky.
Bye.